Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello again, everyone. Now we continue our series, 10 Conversations for the 10th Anniversary. Today, another pair of guests to reflect on how things have changed since 9/11/2001. And this time, they are brothers. Franklin Foer, editor-at-large and former editor-in-chief of the New Republic magazine. He has a reflection in this week's New York magazine on the use of the word freedom since 9/11. And his brother, Jonathan Safran Foer, the writer best known for his two novels, Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, the 2005 novel built around a 9-year-old boy whose father is killed at the Trade Center. Jonathan will have a piece in next week's New Yorker magazine about being a father in the post-9/11 world. Franklin and Jonathan, thank you so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Let me start here, if I can. Your grandfather, Louis Safran, was a Holocaust survivor. Do you think that informs the way either of you have related to 9/11 in your personal lives or as writers? Jonathan, you want to start?
Well, I mean, certainly it's influenced how I write, at least in the sense that my first book was in very many ways about him and about the place that he came from and about an effort to make some kind of connection to him through an absent history, a lost history. But in terms of my relationship to September 11th, I don't think so, actually.
I think it actually did, Jonathan. I mean, I think that we grew up with a sense of absence in our lives, just given that given the absence of our grandfather and the absence of so many of our familial relatives. And I don't know. I suspect that subconsciously there was a reason that you turned from the Holocaust to September 11th, where absence is such a big theme in both works.
It's possible, but a lot of writers have turned, and more are turning as time passes, to September 11th. I mean, it's hard to separate the strands. You know, everyone has a personal history, obviously. Everyone has different forms of loss or absence in their background. But how you distinguish that from, you know, what it means to be a New Yorker reflecting on September 11th as opposed to somebody who lives somewhere else, or maybe a young person rather than an older person, or someone with now children as opposed to someone who doesn't have children. You know, I guess you're right. You know, certainly that was part of my response, but I don't know that it was a dominant part of it.
And your two novels have been Holocaust-related and 9/11-related. It would be crazy to ask, is this a coincidence? So I'll ask, how are they related?
I don't think it's crazy to ask. I mean, one of the strange things about writing, at least in my experience of writing, is that I've never written the thing that I set out to write. If someone had given me a description of my first novel before I wrote it, I would never have believed that I would be the person to write it, and I'm not sure I would have even been interested in reading it. And with my second novel, there's no sense in which it started off as a book about September 11th, or even with September 11th in the background.
Really?
It just evolved into that, and some of that has to do with my writing process, which is really open to change and open to, you know, pursuing instincts or curiosities, and also, you know, obviously how the world changed. I had started that book in 2000, and September 11th
intruded,
and it's very difficult as a writer not to write about the things that you are having strong thoughts and feelings about, and it's just hard to imagine anybody, but particularly a New Yorker, who wasn't having a lot of strong thoughts and feelings about September 11th. So, you know, yes, there are a lot of similarities, but that doesn't mean that they're deliberate.
Jonathan Safran Foer, Franklin Foer, my guests on WNYC in our 10 Conversations on the 10th Anniversary series. And you're both being published in major local magazines in relation to the anniversary. Franklin, your piece in New York Magazine is about the idea of freedom after 9/11 being misunderstood by both left and right. And I actually want to get into the content of it in a minute. Jonathan, yours will be more personal in The New Yorker. Does this say something about how you each navigate the world through your writing, Franklin?
I think it probably does. I mean, obviously, we've chosen two different variations on the same discipline, and Jonathan was drawn towards the novel and towards imaginative writing. And growing up, I think it's possible to look back and see the roots of that, just because he's always been a very acute observer and always emotionally sensitive.
Carefully chosen words.
he was a crybaby in a picture. I could rephrase that.
Maybe the last appearance they ever make together. Anyway, go ahead.
I do think if you look at the novel and at a lot of the political writing in response to 9/11, I think you can see the two essential qualities of those forms shine through. The novel, to be a great novelist, you need to have this amazing sense of empathy. And to be a journalist or a political thinker, you do need to have empathy, but detachment is also a virtue that is celebrated. And there's obvious tension between being an empathetic observer and a detached observer. And I think if you look at the novels and a lot of the nonfiction that have been produced since 9/11, I think you could say that they both exhibited this, and they both could have stood probably to some extent to have benefited from the other's virtues. I think if you look at a lot of the one instinct among a lot of political observers was to categorize the attacks instantly as an outburst of evil. And I think if you look at a lot of the responses of a lot of novelists in the days following 9/11 and afterwards, I think that there was a tendency to look more at to have more of an empathetic understanding of where the attacks were emanating from. And probably in retrospect, we could have all probably stood to have, as a culture, a better balance between empathetic understanding of the context in which terrorism flowed from, and I think we quite correctly as a culture probably identified the attackers as evil from the outset, and that was appropriate.
Jonathan, want to pick it up?
Well, I think in a way Frank is gesturing at something that felt so true at the time, which was there was a desire for a definitive version. Whether it was, in the realm of journalism or in the realm of the novel. Novels, I think, generally suffer from this when they're about historical events, or rather the reading of them suffers from this desire for a 9/11 novel. Is a young child the appropriate hero of a 9/11 novel, of the 9/11 novel? There was a kind of shrinking of perspective or relativism a shrinking of the appreciation of many voices after September 11th, particularly in the weeks and months after. There was an anxiety, I think, about a willingness to see it from different perspectives. I'm not talking about good and evil. I'm just talking about, literally the different ways that people were measuring their distance from it, feeling it, and thinking about it. So, Frank and I might approach the event from quite different perspectives, and that's interesting. But also interesting is how, within the perspectives that we've chosen, there is this. It seems like there's a desire to settle on something, to figure out how is it that we as a culture think about it, instead of, allowing for multiple experiences and perspectives.
Franklin, do you want to keep that going?
I'm just thinking back on the novels that I've read about September 11th and the world after September 11th. And there's one subgenre that I think has been particularly resonant with me, which is novels written from the perspective of Muslim Americans. That you had Lorraine Adams' book Harbor, which was about a guy who gets about an Arab immigrant to the United States and his travails and the way he gets caught up in the war on terror, and Amy Waldman's book The Submission, which is about a Muslim architect who is chosen to build a 9/11 memorial, and just the ways in which, as a sheer matter of empathy and observation, they're able to effectively convey this experience, which really hasn't always been part of the journalistic conversation. And I think what Jonathan's saying is also that that's a very observational, narrow way into September 11th. It's not an attempt to provide some sort of grand, transcendent, definitive explanation. And I think that the novels that have aspired to provide that definitive explanation have actually failed, just because it's so difficult to use the novel as a way of advancing a grand mm-hmm. political or sociological theory.
Yeah. And what? Yeah. Go ahead. Did you want?
I think that what Extremely Loud does so well is it just captures. It's about the emotional aftermath of September 11th, and that's something also that it seems to me that the novel does a far better job of capturing than any work of nonfiction.
It reminds me, Jonathan, that when Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close came out in 2005, you were quoted in the Times saying that you needed to write something that wasn't politicized or commercialized, something human, and then you used the phrase something with no message. And I was intrigued by that idea of needing to write something about 9/11 with no message. Did you mean no attempt to create an overarching truth of what happened on that day and what it meant?
Your guess is as good as mine. That was a long time ago.
I know, it's one little quote and one little answer. I shouldn't read too much into it, but go ahead.
I think probably what I meant is I wanted to write something that felt experientially true rather than intellectually true. Not that one has to choose, but, you know, novels tend to they aspire to a very different kind of truth than journalism does. And unfortunately, I think another distressing habit in the culture is reading novels as journalism, you know, wanting them to present a kind of message in the historical or biographical sense, as opposed to creating an experience that feels authentic. So, you know, when the ideal response for me from a reader would be, yes, that feels true to me. Yes, that's how I experienced it. Yes, those are the words that I didn't previously have for the experience that I had. And, you know, it's interesting the ways that the culture handled journalism and art after September 11th. There were a lot of sort of art controversies, like Eric Fischel's sculpture, you might remember, of a falling man, mm-hmm. Raised a huge storm. And there was this question, is it too soon? Not only is it too soon, but is it inherently wrong to make art out of this subject? And, you know, if you applied those questions to journalism, it would seem crazy. You know, nobody picked up their Times on September 12th with the headline, you know, America Under Attack or whatever it was.
Yeah, and said it's too early to write about this.
Right.
And you know, that might partially explain the rise of nonfiction bestsellers over fiction bestsellers, Franklin, in the years immediately after September 11th. I don't know if it's still true, but they, right. you know, quickly started to be called the years of the nonfiction book. And maybe because it was too soon to do great works of art about 9/11. I don't know if that's starting to even out now, there certainly was an appetite for nonfiction and a kind of waning of an appetite for fiction after that, Franklin.
Right. And I think what Jonathan's saying was that it's almost telling that the most celebrated novel of the last decade was probably Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, which did try to provide almost a journalistic summing up of an era. But I do think that this was a moment that was incredibly well suited towards for nonfiction, that there was this appetite to understand phenomenon that were foreign to most Americans. And so you had a series of books and articles that were produced that I think represented a kind of renaissance of nonfiction, where you did have journalists playing this old role of authoritative translators of phenomenon to the reading public. I'm thinking of Lawrence Wright's extraordinary book, The Looming Tower, that you had Steve Call's Ghost Wars, you had Andrea Elliott's reporting in the New York Times, you had the New York Times itself in the days and weeks and months after September 11th, where it did a wonderful job of cataloging the loss,
right,
and
the Portraits of Grief series, right, to take one, right, example.
Right, exactly.
The brothers and writers, Franklin and Jonathan Safran Foer, my guests on WNYC, the latest in our Series 10 Conversations for the 10th anniversary, part of our Decade 9-11 series on WNYC. By the way, Lawrence Wright, who you mentioned, will be one of the conversants next week. Lawrence Wright in conversation with Fawaz Jurjess coming up next week. We will take a short break, and then I do want to get into some of the ideas in, Franklin, your new article in New York Magazine about the idea of freedom post 9-11, and Jonathan, a little of what you're going to have in the New Yorker next week, which is more on the personal side. I'll probably ask how you think New York, since one of you lives in New York, and how Washington, since the other of you lives there, kind of culturally react to this anniversary differently, or maybe to the whole 10-year period. And listeners, if you want to get in on this conversation, Jonathan Safran Foer is with us. Franklin Foer is with us. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post your comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue our Series 10 Conversations for the 10th anniversary. Today, another pair of guests, and we're doing this mostly in pairs, to reflect on how things have changed since 9/11/2001. Franklin Foer, editor-at-large and former editor-in-chief of The New Republic magazine. He has a reflection in this week's New York magazine on the use of the word freedom after 9/11. And his brother, Jonathan Safran Foer, the writer best known for his two novels, Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, the 2005 book built around a 9-year-old boy whose father is killed at the Trade Center. Jonathan will have a piece in next week's New Yorker about being a father in the post 9/11 world. And Franklin, on the piece you wrote about the idea of freedom, I see it reflected in the editor's note in the New Republic too, I think, this week. And your thesis seems to be that President Bush overreached and abused the idea of freedom to justify the Iraq war, but then liberals overreacted by dismissing global freedom as a basis for U.S. foreign policy. Am I getting it right?
More or less. I mean, I think that my argument is that after September 11th, it was quite natural as Americans for us to reach back to freedom in a way to rhetorically explain what happened on September 11th, that if you look at Al-Qaeda manifestos, they certainly despise pluralism in the West. And if you were to look at the Muslim world, I think that you could correctly argue that repressive regimes in the region helped breed terrorism and resentment of the United States, and our support of those regimes helped breed terrorism and resentment. But what happened after September 11th is a couple of things. One is that Bush elevated freedom to grand American strategy, and he announced our goal was nothing short than ending tyranny in the world. And so that happened. And then also I'd say that freedom got caught up in a lot of the old culture wars of the 1960s and 1980s. And it was a reprise of this grand old debate between the Manichaean moralizers and the spineless relativists. And suddenly freedom had nothing to do with any of the foreign policy discussions and nothing to do with the attacks of 9/11. And it became about, on the right, as a bludgeon to use against against Democratic candidates who were portrayed as appeasers and soft on terrorism and somehow un-American because they were unable to recite this this fundamental American precept. And I think that the left, in some ways, overreacted to this attack, and I think it let them kind of knock them off of some of their fundamental principles. And I think Obama administration foreign policy is probably a good example of that. I think that Obama came into office promising a new tone and a new direction in American foreign policy, and that was very much needed. But on the other hand, I think that he bent too far in the direction of reacting against the Bush doctrine mm-hmm. and pursued a policy of engagement with regimes which happened to be on the brink of tumbling. And so you have this great uprising in the Middle East right now where you have these brave citizens rising up against their despotic governments at precisely the moment that we were extending a hand to them.
Yeah. And Bush's idea of freedom was seductive to some liberals, I think we should remember, not just conservatives,
absolutely.
Which is why there were liberal hawks before the war began. Like,
right.
If America failed to put political freedom over support for friendly dictators in the Middle East, like Mubarak and the Saudi royal family, no wonder they hate us over there. No wonder the U.S. is seen as their oppressor, and a group springs up to declare war on us that's not a country. From a liberal viewpoint, it does actually make a lot of sense. At least in theory,
that's the way that I saw the world after September 11th, and actually, I think was a source of some arguments between Jonathan and myself about the right way to respond to September 11th. And it's complicated to disentangle the theoretical and philosophical case from the way in which it was pursued by
right.
the Bush administration, and I think that in retrospect, the Bush administration will always be judged incredibly harshly for its policies and its execution and a lot of its hypocrisy, as well as its incompetence in its pursuit of those policies. But I think given the way in which the Arab Spring has shaken out, there'll be some sympathy for the fundamental analysis of the Middle East.
As the pendulum swings back toward freedom as central to American foreign policy. Jonathan, what was the disagreement between the two of you at the time that he was referring to?
I don't exactly know what he's referring to.
Let me refresh your memory, Jonathan. I think after the attacks, I think I remember having a debate with Jonathan about the right policy to pursue in Afghanistan. And I think that it was a time when all opinions were unsettled, except that I was probably more strident than Jonathan in advocating retaliation against Al-Qaeda and rooting out of terrorist camps in Afghanistan. And Jonathan was more skeptical of that. More measured.
Do you remember there was a period after September 11th, and it's very hard to remember now, when a lot of Gore voters were expressing gratefulness that Bush was the president? You know, we were leading with
That was short-lived.
It was short-lived, but that it lived at all is telling, speaks volumes to the extent to which our fear was guiding us, our anxiety was guiding us, and maybe even our hunger for you know, revenge or justice, to put it more kindly.
From our comments page, Tim in Midtown writes, "Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close is a personal favorite. I'm interested in Jonathan's use of the page of a book as a medium of expression, that is, photos, letters running together, pages of numbers, etc. In his view, how does this enhance the story of 9/11?
I don't know that it enhanced. I mean, you know what? That question gets at the point I was making before, you know, the idea of there being a story of 9/11.
Yeah.
I was writing a particular version of a story, a particular version, rather, of 9/11 that was from the perspective of this very hyper-imaginative, flamboyant, curious, creative, and slightly weird kid who, you know, to me, the book having a visual language was a kind of extension of his way of being in the world. I suppose there's another way of looking at it, which is September 11th was the most visually documented event in human history. Nothing has been witnessed by as many people as the
flames.
The flames, yeah, and the collapsing towers. And there is a visual truth, you know, at the bottom of the day. People sometimes talk about the difference in the British response to their terror attacks to the American response, and you know, question why is it that British people seem to exhibit more fortitude or a greater willingness to just get on with life. And I think, you know, if there was any difference at all, a lot of it probably had to do with how relatively visual and invisible the events were. You know, one took place. Whenever people talk about September 11th, one of the first things you always hear is, I remember what the weather was that day. You know, it was a perfectly clear day. It was a beautiful blue sky. And, of course, the London bombings took place almost entirely underground. So I think a lot of the trauma was actually a result of seeing the nightmare play out in front of us.
The fact that your character, the child Oscar Schell, invents all these, should I call them, safety devices in his mind. What about frozen planes, which could be safe from heat-seeking missiles? What about subway turnstiles that were also radiation detectors? What about incredibly long ambulances that connected every building to a hospital, reading some of the dialogue? Is that something in you? And then, Franklin, I wonder if there's something in the journalistic impulse to write, to try to save people from future pain?
Well, I mean, adults had their own versions. You know, what about an escape plan out of the city? Or what about stockpiling some, you know, non-perishables in the basement? Or what about replacing those flashlight batteries? I think everyone had some version of that. Obviously, you know, this is one of the reasons I wanted to choose a kid as a narrator of this book, because they are allowed to be open wounds. You know, they are unconstrained by self-consciousness or all of the other things that, you know, make fear difficult to speak about among adults. But I don't think the concerns that would lead Oscar to creating those things are unique to Oscar or unique to children.
Franklin?
Yeah, I agree. You have to be superhuman to be able to withstand the impulse of the impulses of anger and fear and anxiety. And and I remember you asked about conversations between Jonathan and I about September 11th, and the one that I most vividly recall is when the plane that was going to, I think, the Dominican Republic exploded over Queens, and I think I just remember my complete terror about Jonathan in the course of that moment, which was probably not a rational fear at all, but it was, I think, the inevitable.
Why about him? Why about him?
I happened to live in the neighborhood at the time, and
so it wasn't so irrational.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say a different conversation. I was sure you were, which was on the morning of September 11th. You know, when we had our first, I think a lot of people remember the first contact, you know, with a loved one. Not in the sense of seeing if they were safe, but just to try to unfold a little bit what had happened. And I remember that we said, I love you, to each other. which is was probably the first time we'd said it in years. I mean, maybe, you know, a long time. And I remember being struck by that, and that in a way being, you know, silly as it might sound, but a real indicator of how shaken up I was and how shaken up you were.
Franklin?
That's right. And one of my first reactions was after the attacks, I had wandered down to the White House, and it just it was so bizarre to see Washington completely shuttered, and the silence of the city was the terror of the city. And but one of my most immediate next reactions was to walk up Connecticut Avenue to go to my parents' house to go back into essentially the womb at that moment, because that was what felt right.
And Jonathan, you live in New York. Franklin, you live in Washington. The novelist in New York, the journalist in D.C. So the two cities directly attacked on 9/11. Do you think there's been a New York culture way of responding over the last 10 years and a Washington culture way that are similar or different from each other? Franklin, have you thought about that?
Well, you know, I think that New York was rightly so much the source of this national outpouring. And Washington, much less so. And I think that New York really, New York's place in the national imagination was fixed after September 11th, and it became this kind of transcendent capital for the country, even though it's firmly implanted in a blue state and all that. And I think that Washington, over the course of this last decade, has continued a process that began well before September 11th, which is that it is respected by almost no one. And I think that the fact that Washington's fall in continued fall in the nation's esteem is broadly reflective of the fact that after September 11th, I think a lot of people have this fantasy that a leader who was not Bush could have healed a lot of the divisions in the country and avoided a lot of the polarization in the country. And I'm not entirely sure that that's the case. I think that a lot of the divisions that we're now witnessing are flow from grand structural fractures in the country and were inevitable. But I don't think it was inevitable that that Washington as a symbol for government and as a symbol for the nation would continue its fall in the way that it has. And as a lifelong resident of the city, that makes me tremendously sad.
Jonathan?
To me, New York is now what it was before September 11th. I think there was a period when it felt really palpably different. There were a couple of months when, you know, as corny as it sounds or as hard to believe as it sounds, people really were, there was there was an explicit camaraderie. You know, there was like a kind of almost repulsive kindness, actually. And there was an opportunity, maybe, as Frank is saying, there was with D.C., to reinvent the city somewhat. I think the design for Ground Zero was an opportunity to reinvent the city, and there were some really amazing designs. The one by Peter Eisenman and Stephen Hole continues to sort of... I think about it a lot whenever I pass Ground Zero and see, you know, what they're building, which is to me not the best of New York, but also a kind of a symbol of what maybe could have been if some different decisions were made.
And we didn't talk about your forthcoming article, Jonathan. I don't know if you're allowed to because it's not out yet. It'll be next week's New Yorker. But parenting is a theme.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about, as I think a lot of parents, Frank probably thinks about this too, how to, you know, we both Frank and I are the parents of young children who are too young to know about, you know, to distinguish the 11th from any other day in September. And, you know, what it will be like trying to put that into language. You know, there's certain aspects of it that are very easy to put into language. But just the explaining the sort of broken contract of my thought that I lived in a world in which this wasn't possible, or I thought I lived in a city at least in which this wasn't possible, will be very, very difficult. And I think, you know, obviously that's a burden every parent feels wherever they live, but I think it's a special and different burden because of September 11th.
Where will you both be on the anniversary itself? Will you be commemorating other than with the writings that we've been talking about?
I have no idea. And in fact, it's something that kind of bothers me about our culture in general, which is that we do such a poor job of memorializing the past, and that we have almost no rituals for remembering that are common and shared, and that so many of the memorials and rituals that we do have are either syrupy or devoid of emotional power. And that I think one theme that has come around a couple times in this conversation is fragmentation of our culture. And there's nothing, maybe it's our national character and our dynamism and our pluralism that we do such a bad job of remembering the past in some sort of ritualistic sort of way that helps us come to terms with it. We don't have that, and I actually have no idea what I'm going to be doing on September 11th.
Jonathan, you'll get a last word.
I couldn't put it better than my brother just did. And I also don't know what I'm going to be doing on that day, but I'm sure I won't be down at Ground Zero.
All right. Well, the family is reunited in that last answer after the intense disagreements of the last 40 minutes. Actually, this has been wonderful, and I really, really appreciate the two of you coming out to do this. Franklin Foer, editor-at-large and former editor-in-chief of the New Republic magazine. He has a reflection in this week's New York magazine on the use of the word freedom after 9/11. And Jonathan Safran Foer, the writer best known for his two novels, Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. And he will have a piece in next week's New Yorker magazine about being a father in the post-9/11 world. I know our listeners have been really, really appreciating the depth and thoughtfulness and sensitivity of this conversation. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
And tomorrow, this series continues, our series of 10 conversations for the 10th anniversary. Radio rookies from WNYC, teenagers Brendan Illis and Noren Basuni, in conversation with Clifford Chanin, the executive director at the education director at the 9/11 Memorial Museum. Join us for that. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up next, for something completely different, it's draft week, and we'll take a look inside the fantasy football industry. Stay with us.